It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This week on the podcast, what can I say? I have the delightful Lizanne Saunders on. She is the chief investment strategist and member of the firm's investment committee at Schwab. The firm has $8.5 trillion on its platform. We've been working with Schwab for a long time. Lizanne was one of the earliest guests on the show, and we reminisce a little bit about that first appearance. I don't know what else to say about her. She's so insightful and so knowledgeable and has such a wonderful perch overseeing, you know, $8.5 trillion of both individual mom-and-pop investors, advisors. They're the biggest platform as a custodian for advisors. My disclosure, my firm also uses them. And she just sees the world from a place that not a lot of people in the industry get to do. Not only do they have a giant research team, but she gets to see fund flows. She gets to see a huge amount of activity from the inside. And she, on a regular basis, speaks to investors, speaks to advisors, speaks to institutions. She is as much in the mix, in the thick of what's going on in the world of investing as anybody. And that combination of her unique perch and perspective and her deep experience as either a fund manager or a strategist for the past 38 years, unparalleled in the world of investing. I found this conversation to simply be delightful. And I think you will also. With no further ado, Charles Schwab's Lizanne Saunders. I listened to the first conversation we had. It's like the second year I was doing this. It was 2015. You were great. I was awful.
That was not the first time we met. I remember that conversation 9 years ago, but that was not the first time we met.
The first time we met was my first time doing television.
I remember that.
In a tiny little room around a round table with Larry Kudlow, and I'll never forget banging down 2 Diet Cokes, walking out the door to go to the men's room, and the producer grabs me, "Let's go. We're live." And that was it. I sat there for an hour with my back teeth floating. And I remember a friend said, "You're fidgety. Don't move around. Just pick a spot to look." And the spot was your front teeth, which are perfect and white and still perfect and white.
Well,
and so, I know why.
Well,
now I know why.
In between that time that we first sat down and did this, and then this is a couple of years ago now, we live in Naples, Florida, and it was the night before Thanksgiving. We walked out of a restaurant and I just walked off the curb the wrong way.
Uh-oh.
And the first thing to hit the pavement.
Your teeth.
Was my teeth.
So those are not...
Now parts of it. It chipped the part of the right front tooth and the tooth next to it. And fortunately, my sister's next door neighbor was a dentist. And he went in Thanksgiving morning and
really?
And fixed it. Yeah.
I T-boned a car. I was the T-bonee. Oof. Right in front of my dentist's office. And when I called the next morning, say, "Hey, I chipped my front tooth. I need it fixed." They said, "Oh, you too. There was a bad accident in front of..."
That was me.
Yeah, that was me. my wife was really upset I totaled her car at like 5 miles an hour. An SUV plowed into us.
Totaled?
Totaled.
5 miles an hour.
So I was making a left. The person behind me thought I was going straight and tried to pass me on the left.
Yeah.
So literally, I made a left right into them. And it's funny because that was a pandemic purchase, a very inexpensive 2017 Panamera 4S, which everybody walked away. I mean, we were a little banged up, but, you know, a giant SUV just crunched us. And what's terrible is when you see the car afterwards and you see the driver's door, like, holy cow, how did I just...
How did I walk away from that?
That was geez. Whenever people say, you don't need to buy a new car, it's like, I want the latest, greatest.
With airbags, with 177
seat
airbags.
Seatbelt tensioners.
And, yes,
by the way,
absolutely.
The airbags come down. You can't sit. It was so disorienting because I'm trying to turn the wheel. Wheel wouldn't turn.
I can't imagine driving in a car without a seatbelt on. You know, before we started this, Barry, we were talking about our age and baby boomers. When I was brought home from the hospital in 1964, it was in my mom's lap.
Okay, I'll tell you, I'll take that a step further. My dad had this giant, it was an Impala. And we used to lie on the rear deck under the back window.
Oh, yeah.
Like, if there's an accident, you're a projectile right out the windshield.
We had a station wagon. We'd go from northern New Jersey to Brooklyn to visit grandparents, and sleeping bags would be laid out in the back.
And now you can't take a kid home from the hospital without the right, not just a car seat, has to be the right car seat.
I'm not saying what was going on back in the 60s was the right thing.
It toughened you up. You go through a few windshields, you know, you learn to dust yourself off.
Fortunately, haven't had that.
All right, let's get serious. So everybody knows you as the chief investment strategist at Schwab, but let's roll back to the early part of your career. You get a BA in economics and poli-sci from the University of Delaware. What was the original career plan?
I didn't have one.
None?
Well, not in college, no. In fact, what started as that double major ultimately morphed into the official degree being in international relations, but to be perfectly honest, I just decided to study a couple different areas that were very broad brush because I didn't know what I wanted to do when I graduated.
International relations, so you go to the Kennedy School and then become a diplomat?
I thought about going to graduate school right away for political science. I looked into American University, and then I thought to myself, I don't know what I want to do yet. So all I knew throughout the latter part of my undergraduate years is that I wanted to live and work in New York City. That was the dream. Born in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, then early part of childhood in Morristown, New Jersey, then outside of Philadelphia in Westchester, Pennsylvania, then of course went to Delaware and then New York City for 12 years and then Connecticut, raised our kids in Darien, Connecticut, and now I'm based in Naples, Florida.
Right. Do you have the little golf cart and you're puttering
around?
No
golf cart, no.
Not quite
but
there
but
yet.
A Vespa.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, that's fun. So you come out of college. How did you end up at Avatar Associates working with Marty Zweig?
So I interviewed across the spectrum of industries, and they were all interviews for grunt positions, entry-level positions. But I had interviews at a few Wall Street firms, both large and small. I think I interviewed at a marketing firm, an ad agency, because I didn't know what I wanted to do. But I had some familiarity with Marty because in college, one of the courses that I took, a requirement was, in addition to reading the Wall Street Journal every day, was understanding what had happened in the world of financial markets throughout the week. And I had a professor give me a little sort of hint. He said, hey, just watch Wall Street Week on PBS on
Lewis
Friday
Rukeyser.
Nights. Lewis Rukeyser. At 8:30 to 9 o'clock, then, you know, you go out and you start your weekend. And I did. And Marty was on that show really from its inception in the early 1970s. And for those that remember the show, you also remember that that predated anything that exists now.
That was the
that
original
was
finance
that was
show
it.
Before there was three or four different
That's right.
financial news networks.
And
it was
millions of viewers every week. It was that era's version of must-see TV on the subject of the market. So I had some familiarity. But in advance of the interview, I also did more research on Marty, on his side of the organization, which was the mutual fund, hedge fund, investment newsletter side, and then the Avatar side that I ultimately joined, which was the institutional money management firm at Barry, as a reminder, back in 1986, the process of doing research on a person or a firm, there was
no... You didn't just Google them.
No, there was no Google. There were no computers. There was no internet. So I was in the library with the microfiche machine
sure.
and literally turning the crank and reading newspaper articles. So I had some background and had two interviews. And honestly, just the voice inside my head said, this feels right.
You're there for 13 years, mm-hmm. 1986 to 99. That was the great bull market.
Yep.
Tell us a little bit what it was like during that period. And then we'll talk about what it was like working with Marty Zweig, the late, great Marty Zweig.
So, again, I was on the avatar side of the Zweig Avatar broader organization, which was institutional money management, managing money for a lot of large corporate plans and foundations and endowments. And I was a portfolio manager. So I was doing bottom-up research and picking stocks, but it was with the context of the top-down analysis that Marty brought to the picture. I learned throughout that 13 years, and part of the reason why I took advantage of an opportunity that presented itself to move over to U.S. Trust was I was much more interested in and fascinated by the top down and not the bottom up. I didn't love picking stocks. It wasn't where my passion was. So my observations were more keen on what Marty and his models were doing in the context of the big picture and monetary policy analysis and investor sentiment and behavior. And that was where I really found my passion, was in that top-down analysis.
So let's talk a little bit about Marty Zweig, one of that era's most famous investors and traders. The technical crew know him for the Zweig thrust indicator. He created the put-call ratio.
Yeah.
But he's also the guy who coined the phrase, don't fight the Fed. Tell us a little bit what it was like to work with Marty Zweig.
I adored Marty. You know, rest in peace. He was quirky. He could have a temper, but never about the big stuff. It was more about the little stuff. If he couldn't find his pencil and, you know, he would toss a phone, but he was really sort of warm and fuzzy, but had that. He was always sort of anxious and nervous.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people who just observed him from afar took it as, well, he's just bearish all the time. It wasn't the case. I mean, he was essentially a market timer, for lack of a better word. He was a tactical asset allocator.
And one of the more rare successful market timers.
Unbelievably successful. And it had to do with the discipline of the models that he used and how he segmented economic liquidity, investor liquidity, and then technicals and breadth conditions, and understood how they melded together. And, it wasn't. The history of working for him wasn't without some periods that he didn't quite nail, but the big ones he really nailed.
When I was early in my career, I read the book Winning on Wall Street, mm-hmm. which I think came out in like 95 or 96.
Well, the original one came out earlier than that, but there were editions that that followed that.
But
it's still a must read.
And my takeaway from that is, market timing is one part science, where you're crunching numbers and looking at history, but you can't get away from one part art, where after you're watching the markets for decades like him, there's an intuitive feel where just something starts to
right.
smell wrong.
Right.
And when the data lines up and your spidey sense starts
yep.
to tingle, and he never quite said it that way, but I very much got the sense that all the data was there to buttress the fact that, hey, I've been watching markets for 50 years and something wicked this way comes.
The gut instinct was extraordinary. It was always, again, in the context of the models that he was very disciplined about, but there was that just added little piece, and it certainly came into play with regard to what essentially was his crash call.
So let's talk about that. So he's a regular on Wall Street Week with Louis Rukeyser. I could still see the dollar sign in the street, the S for the street. In the logo. The Friday before Black Monday, he goes on Rukeyser. What does he say?
For those that don't remember the show, and it's, you know, with every year that goes by, I still hear all the time, oh my gosh, I miss Wall Street Week. I miss Lou. What was he like? What was Marty like? And younger people just never heard of the show. They have no idea who Ulla Schrodkaiser is. And that's kind of sad for somebody that's been around for as long as I have. But the structure of the show was Lou would come out and he would do 10 minutes or so of a monologue. And it was really brilliant writing. He wrote them all himself. There was humor. There was great intelligence on what had happened in the market. There was really important reminders around what matters and what doesn't. And he was just sort of a calming force and influence, especially during tumultuous times. But then he would walk over to the table, where at the table was Lou and the three regular panelists that were on that evening. And there was 21, 2, 3 panelists on an ongoing basis. And he would have a conversation with each panelist. And then all four would go over to the sofa area and interview the special guest for that night. So this was the middle part of the show where he was talking to the panelists. And Marty was his typical, And I think Lou asked him, and you can find it on YouTube.
It's still around.
It is still around.
In fact, a bunch of the Wall Street Week episodes around.
A bunch of them
are.
That's the one to watch.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think Lou said, "Boy, you sound a little troubled. Do you think we have a bear market?" And Marty basically said, "No, I think the market's going to crash." And then he went further to talk about the nature of what it would look like, the probability that it would happen, but then there would be a retest. But then once you had the retest, a decent chance that you'd be off to the races again.
Pretty much exactly what
happened. Exactly what happened.
Like, not just, oh, the market's going to lose some points on Monday. He laid out, like, the next 6 months, and it's exactly what happened.
And it had to do with the interest rate backdrop at the time and tighter monetary conditions, but also the spidey sense, to your point, around the innovation of the time of portfolio insurance and felt that was sort of unwinding and wasn't going to represent the insurance that a lot of people thought. And, you know, he was on the hedge fund side of the dual organization, so could swing for the fences a bit more than we could on the institutional side. And I don't remember the exact percentages, but was very aggressively long heading into what the pre-crash peak was in August. And then started aggressively both selling and moving to the short side of things, heading right into the weekend before the crash. And we did something similar on the institutional side, not the same extreme, but close to fully invested to a very, very low equity exposures.
And people may not remember, 1987 was, at least up and through September, was a robust year in the market.
Sure,
we were up like 30 or 40%, like a really substantial gain. And despite the 22.7% crash, I think we finished the year like up 1%,
I think it was 1.8%. Okay. And you know what, Barry? I'm glad you mentioned that. So indulge me, if you would, on a tangent here. One of the things that I have never done and no one at Schwab has ever asked me to do is what I think is the silly exercise of things like year-end price targets. Now, in part, that's a way for institutional strategists to be measured against one another. And the sort of narrative embedded in that, I suppose, might matter to institutions. But our $8+ trillion...
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
of client assets are, for the most part, individual investors. Right. 1987 is a perfect example of that. If I, at the beginning of the year, had said the market is going to be up less than 2%, that might have sent the impression that it was going to be kind of a boring year and could have patted myself on the back at the end of the year. But the path that the market took to start at the year and then end at up 1.8% was nothing resembling what one might infer if you just heard the year-end price target of essentially a flat market.
So I love the mental exercise that Wes Gray of Alpha Architect does. Hey, if you knew with perfect clarity, if that bird landed on your shoulder and told you, here's where equity prices are going to be in 10 years, position your portfolio for that. He says, even God would get fired as a portfolio manager because the drawdowns right. can be so vicious. And what do you mean you're fully invested? The market is down, you know, 30-40%. You didn't see this
when
coming.
Markets are going up. The benchmark is either an index like the S&P 500 or, you know, someone you know that's making even more money than you are. But it's amazing how quickly the benchmark turns into cash or a positive return when markets are going down.
So let's talk a little bit about a day in the life of a chief investment strategist at an $8 trillion firm. I have to assume every day is a little different.
I was going to say, depends on the day.
So take us through a typical day. What's it like?
Well, there is probably nothing typical about a day, but on the rare occasion where I have a decent block of time where I am not on camera or traveling, I do a lot of research. I remember when my daughter was in middle school, and she's 24 years old now, and she's the youngest. It was a long time ago. The school had a career day, and I was asked to come in as one of the representatives to have kids rotate through the classroom they assigned you to and talk about what you do. Particularly for a job like mine, the directive from the principal was try to get the seventh graders to understand what you do. So I started by saying, well, basically I read, write, and talk. So that's what I spend my typical day doing, is some form of reading, writing, and talking. And the reading part is the digestion of just a fire hose of information, proprietary research, internal Schwab research, all the research that I get from the variety of research sources that we have, analyzing data, analyzing every economic report that comes in, everything happening in the market on a day-to-day basis, even though I don't take a trading approach, just looking at technicals and breadth statistics and leadership and factor analysis, et cetera, et cetera. And then I spent a lot of time both literally and figuratively on the road talking to our clients, both the retail clients as well as advisor services. Now in this post-COVID environment, it's not quite as much as used to be the case in terms of travel to do in-person events. It's maybe 60% back in that direction, but we've all adopted to the use of—
Isn't that a better balance?
It's a better balance, and it's efficient.
Right.
I used to go over to Asia once or twice a year to see many of our clients that are based over there. And the trips would involve some combination of Hong Kong, Shanghai, Beijing, maybe Singapore. And I would do a breakfast event, a lunch event, a dinner event. The dinner events might have up to 150, 200 people, smaller other events. But at the end of a trip, it was, you know, a brutal travel trip.
Right.
I might have interacted in some form with several hundred clients. I now do a quarterly webcast for those same clients, and there have been webcasts on which we've had more than 5,000 clients. So there is an efficiency to continue to weave that in.
There's no substitute for the face-to-face, but sometimes it's like, do I really need to go here
right.
to meet with 30 people?
Right.
It just seems... So some of the takeaway from a little bit of Zoom, a little bit of webcast have become, hey, we can be more efficient and more productive.
Absolutely.
All these tools existed 10 years ago. The pandemic seems to
forced
have just
adoption.
Accelerated.
Absolutely. And then as you and I sit here having this conversation, a relatively new component of my day-to-day activity is I now co-host a podcast.
I know that.
Yeah,
how are you enjoying that?
Love it. Absolutely love it. So we launched it, I think it was November of last year.
Uh-huh.
I co-host it with my colleague, Kathy Jones, who is our chief fixed income strategist. So she's my counterpart on the fixed income side of things, where my bias is on the equity side of things. And we have just very open, honest conversations, sort of you're a fly on the wall hearing what we would talk about. It's very unscripted about what's going on in the markets. And we talk about the Fed and economic data and what's ahead for the week. And we typically also have guests, both internal
weekly,
and external.
You're doing it weekly.
We're doing it weekly. It drops on Fridays. It's audio only, so we can have external guests, internal guests.
Right.
People can be wherever they are. And a wide range of guests that we have had. We had Claudia Somm. We had Al Rabel talking about commercial real estate. We had Dolly Lenz of real estate fame talking about residential real estate. We've had internal guests like our own Mike Townsend talking about what's going on in Washington. So that's been an absolute blast.
Isn't this, not to toot my own horn, but isn't this just such a pleasant format?
Absolutely.
It's not 3 minutes.
Right.
There's no camera in your face. You know, the world is not black and white, and investing especially has so many shades of gray. And to develop, have a decent explanation as to what's going on, 5 minutes really is too tight.
It really is.
So to go into that sounds great. And I love that description of what you do is reading, writing, and talking is really is great. I wanted to ask you something. You mentioned all of the internal Schwab clients. You have advisors, you have individual clients. Like, I would love to be let loose on that data to see what they do in response to markets. How do you look at the behavior of, whether it's professional or institutional or just mom and pop traders? Do you guys monitor that and say, here's the sentiment? Looks like people are starting to get really panicky.
We do. And there are a variety of forms that we disseminate that type of information out into the public sphere, which is not something I do formally.
Mm-hmm.
There are groups that put that together. But I have access to the information. And you're right, particularly as it relates to the sentiment side of things. I have been a sentiment watcher for my 38 years in this business, learning a lot about the power of sentiment from Marty Zweig. But I think it's important to look at both attitudinal measures of sentiment and behavioral measures of sentiment. And behavioral measures with $8+ trillion of client assets,
someone's going to be acting out when they shouldn't.
It's probably a pretty good eye into the sort of psyche and behavior of individual investors. So it is absolutely something that I incorporate in the analysis, in addition to broader metrics that go beyond just Schwab, things like fund flows and obviously the put-call ratio and other ways to measure the behavior of investors. But it's in conjunction with those more attitudinal measures. And that comes from sources like AAII, American Association of Individual Investors. But frankly, a lot of the attitudinal measures of sentiment I pick up just from talking to our clients, being on the road. That's where the spidey sense, the gut feel comes in. And now being very active on social media too, particularly Twitter/X. By the way, I am not active on either Instagram or Facebook. However, a very troubling, huge rash of imposters on those platforms of me, not just trying to get followers.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised you were
pitching things like...
You're a big Bitcoin advocate on Instagram.
Apparently, that is not me, by the way.
Not on Facebook, not on Instagram.
I'm not active on Facebook. And I've had a rash of imposters on Twitter.
I was about to say, you know, Elon Musk is touting Grok as their AI. And I would never subscribe to that until they were able to demonstrate, hey, Grok has gotten rid of all the spam bots and it's gotten rid of all the, like, I'm constantly reporting fake Barrys. I'm sure you have people reporting.
It
and
is
how can
constant.
They not? It's so easy to identify.
Well,
if AI can't do that, then AI is worthless.
It is. And it drives me crazy that...
It's going away anyway. Twitter circling the
somebody
drain.
Will think it's me.
Right.
And it's somebody... It's an account with, you know, 7 followers.
And 9...
Not that I'm you know, Taylor Swift, but
To be fair, your call on Dogecoin, using the handle LizAnnSaunders973149.
Oh, well, good
was
for
pretty
her.
Well timed.
Good for her. Good for her. Or him or it or whatever.
It's a North Korean spam factory.
For people who might not have been following the actual me, it's at LizAnn Saunders. There's no E at the end of Ann. Saunders is not spelled with a Z. There's no numbers added to it. It drives me crazy. But
it should be one of those things that are just so easy to fix, and he is otherwise distracted.
So it is something that I have to monitor.
And I remember when we spoke last time, 2015.
I think I had just joined Twitter. Yeah,
and
in 2015.
Now for people who don't follow LizAnn Saunders, but you should, and I retweet you on a regular basis.
Thank you.
You put up some really nice charts, some good tables. Everything is data based. Everything is fact oriented. It's none of the stuff that I see from you, and this is why I appreciate your feed. I really think the market has another leg up here, about 10-15%. Then we get a pull. There's none of that crap.
There's none of that. You know why? I don't know. I can't do that.
That's right.
And by the way, nobody knows.
Can. Right.
And nobody can do that. It's not what we know that matters, meaning about the future, what the market's going to do. It's what we do along the way.
Right.
It's as simple as that.
It's a little bit of a stoic philosophy. You can't control the world. All you can control is your reaction to what happens,
Absolutely.
Your behavior.
Yep.
And that's very challenging for people to accept.
Oh. Fear and greed are really, really powerful emotions.
Yes.
And especially as it relates to our money, because we care a lot about our money.
So let's talk about fear and greed. Let's talk about 2022 and 2023. 22 was a tough year. We had double-digit declines in fixed income and equities. I think the S&P was down about almost 20%. The NASDAQ was down about 30%. What was 2022 like for you, dealing with a lot of clients and investors concerned about what was going on?
You know, one of the most interesting things about 2022 was to tie this into the sentiment conversation that we just had and the differential at times between behavioral measures of sentiment and attitudinal measures of sentiment. I'm sure you remember the first big whoosh down into June of 2022 that at the time was the hope for, okay, maybe this is the washout point, in part because some sentiment measures were at extremes. AAII, I don't remember whether it was exactly around the low of June, but sometime in that spring, early summer period, the percentage of bears in the weekly AAII survey went to a record high, and commensurately the percentage of bulls went to a record low. But it wasn't matched by the behavioral measures. In fact, AAII, in addition to their weekly are you bullish, are you bearish, are you neutral survey, they also track the equity exposure of their same
members.
That's
my favorite data point of theirs.
And at the time where you had record high bearishness, record low bullishness, the equity exposure was only slightly off an all-time high. Mm-hmm. So that was a classic example of what they're saying and what they're doing are sort of diametrically opposed. Fast forward to the October 2022 period, there was a little more of that across the spectrum washout, the puke phase, as I like to call it, using a very technical term. That was also a period where, because the Magnificent Seven or the Great Eight, the small handful of tech related.
Now it's the Fabulous Four.
Now it's getting shrunk. Those stocks were dragging performance down. But what was interesting about the October low was what was going on under the surface. So the indexes at the October low had taken out their June low. But under the surface, you were seeing much improved breadth, positive divergence, to use that technical term. And that was a more compelling point in the market. Again, the message from us wasn't the bottom is in, but the message was this looks more compelling than what was happening in June.
Mm-hmm.
Because you had that sort of double washout in sentiment and you had that under the surface improvement in breadth, where even though, the generals were retreating, there were more soldiers kind of approaching the front line.
And the October 2022 lows were slightly below the June lows.
Right.
And so the technicians will say that's a double bottom. But I recall seeing some people say, uh-oh, we're going to start a whole new leg down over here. And it's It's hard to see that with sentiment that negative.
Not only that, but again, the fact that breadth under the surface was improving. Yeah.
And, you know, same thing at my firm. We're not market timers. We're not traders. In my personal account, I went out and bought a bunch of QQQ calls and spider calls just to play around, and Russell 2000 calls. Spiders did well. Russell's did nothing.
Yeah.
And the Qs crushed it over the next year. But that has to be a challenging period. What sort of calls and do you get panicky conversations with investors?
You know, one of the differentiations that I've observed over my many years at Schwab is during some of the really tumultuous eras, 2022 maybe not as significant as the COVID decline or certainly the global financial crisis, is there is a pretty direct correlation between the ability to withstand volatility and tough market environments with whether you sort of have a disciplined strategic asset allocation
right.
plan versus more of the day traders, the wing it kind. That's where you see the bigger emotional swings versus our clients that have taken that, what we sometimes call an advised approach, where they've got that long-term plan, they have a financial plan, they've got a strategic asset allocation structure that is tied to everything personally about them, that they have the disciplines around diversification, periodic rebalancing, and they tend to ride through the tougher times much better than the kind of wing it type investors.
So let's flip it on its head. 2023, S&P 500 up almost 25%, the NASDAQ up more than double that. What do you do with people who suddenly become uber bullish and, hey, this is a new something, we have to be in it to win it? How do you deal with that?
A year like
the
last year
side.
Was so dominant by such a small handful of names. It got less extreme as the year concluded, but at around the midpoint of last year, you not only had the Magnificent Seven accounting for more than all the performance, but you had a record low percentage of the index outperforming the index itself.
145 stocks did better than 25%. 144 stocks in the S&P 500, if I'm remembering correctly, right? Outperforming
the
index
there's
itself.
There's lots of ways
to
look at that. So at the low point of last year, even today, if you look at the percentage of the S&P that has outperformed the index over the past 12 months, it's only 12%. That's close to an all-time low.
Give me those numbers again.
12% of the overall S&P 500.
So you're talking 60 stocks.
Right. Have outperformed the S&P over the prior 12 months. Now, if you start to shorten that 12 months, mm-hmm. it gets better. So right now, it's around 40% of the index has outperformed the index over the past month.
Really? That's much broader.
Much broader.
Because all we hear is people saying, the market is narrowing. This is how bulls end. It's just
wide,
seven.
It's broadening.
It's going the other way.
So
that's
even
constructive.
Yes, it is. Even just among the Magnificent Seven. Now, last year, so that moniker came because those were the seven largest stocks
right.
in the S&P and in the NASDAQ. They're not the seven largest anymore. Six of them are still the six largest, but Tesla has dropped down. It's kind
right.
of bouncing between the ninth and the 10th spot. So leapfrogging Tesla has been Berkshire Hathaway, Eli Lilly, and Broadcom has been, you know, kind of breathing down Tesla's neck. Last year, they were the seven largest stocks consistently throughout the year. They weren't the seven best performers, but they were all strong performers. Double and triple digit, you only had to go down to the 63rd ranking within the S&P 500 to capture all seven of those names. Year to date, as you and I are recording this, three of the seven stocks are ranked year to date performance in the bottom quintile. So three of them have a four handle. In terms of the ranking.
So that's Tesla?
Tesla, Apple, and Alphabet. Now, NVIDIA is still the best performing stock, but you've got this massive spread in terms of performance among just that group of names. And you have these sort of stealthy breakouts happening in areas like industrials, even to some degree in financials.
Which have been a giant laggard for
right.
forever.
But, you know, sectors and groups and
rotate.
Categories, there's rotation. I think all else equal, that's a healthy thing. I think still a bit more work needs to be done. But in terms of back to the original part of your question, you know, how do you navigate this? First of all, understand what's actually going on in the market. Understand that indexes can often paint a very different picture versus if you look under the surface. And that's why in my latest report, I said that this may be more of a duck market than a bull market.
That's literally a question I have. I love the metaphor of a duck. Explain what that means.
I guess is that the quote originally is attributed to Michael Caine, who talked about a duck being very calm on the surface, but paddling like the Dickens underneath. And to put some numbers behind what I mean in this context, that both the S&P and the NASDAQ are still trading around all-time highs, with, in the case of the S&P, no more than a 2% drawdown from a year-to-date high, maximum drawdown. It's a little bit worse, it's 3% for the NASDAQ. But that's at the index level.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Just use the NASDAQ as an example of this. And as you and I are doing this first week in March, we're not very far into the year, but the average member, NASDAQ member, maximum drawdown from year-to-date highs is negative 22%.
That's big.
It's big. That's bear market level decline. So there's a lot more churn going on under the surface. And I think especially in this environment, you want to understand what's going on under the surface, not just make assumptions about the market at the index level because of what has been that bias in terms of performance to just a relatively small handful of names.
So those data points that you bring up are really quite interesting because there has been an increasing chorus of people talking about passive flows and indexing are destroying price discovery. You know, David Einhorn a few weeks ago said passive is destroying value and it's damaging market structure. You're essentially making the case that there's plenty of price discovery, that it's not uniform, that money isn't just flowing into names blindly.
Right.
If Apple, Alphabet, and Tesla are in the bottom quintile of performers when they are amongst the top 10 biggest stocks, that really contradicts. Oh, no,
it means there's just other flows.
There's
other stuff going on.
It's not just fund flows into indexes.
Now, passive did just surpass active in terms of the amount of money in passive ETFs and funds versus active. That just happened at the end of 2023. But dispersion is up and correlations are way down. And I think that that's supportive of active. And that is not me saying sell all your passive vehicles and back up the truck and load up on active. We have always, for years, thought there's a home for both active and passive.
Core and satellite.
In portfolios.
Right.
The point is more that active, in general and broadly, has just not been playing on a level playing field with passive. I think that's improving. And you're right. There is price discovery again. A lot of that has to do with the return of the risk-free rate and an environment in the ZIRP era where—
Competition with bonds, you mean, by return of—
And just, you know, the ZIRP era, 0% interest rate, that was the support for zombie companies and companies that really had no business, existing. And I think with that return of the risk-free rate, it has brought about more price discovery. It has represented a reconnection of fundamentals to prices. Not every day, not every week. You still get these, you know, cap-driven concentration problems in the market like last year, but that's starting to ease a bit. And if you're only looking at the index level and you see certain ugly days, I think the real story, which is arguably a more optimistic story can often be found under the surface, not on the surface.
Huh. That's some really fascinating stuff. And I love that perspective of, here's what the chatter is saying, but when we look at the data, it's telling you something else. All right, last question on Schwab. You've been there, I think, later this year?
24 years.
So your next year is 25 years.
Yes.
That longevity, first of all, is unusual.
Well, for all intents and purposes, two jobs in 38 years.
Not too bad.
So
right?
That's not common on Wall Street, I think.
It's definitely increasingly rare.
Yeah.
The question is, tell us what's kept you at one place for a quarter of a century.
A lot of it has to do with the culture. And I give a tremendous amount of credit to the man behind the firm.
Charlie.
Chuck Schwab, and
yep.
Who is still with us, and he's still a pretty active chairman. And I know him personally as well as professionally, and his vision of what Schwab should be and has turned into is it really, I think, separates us from maybe the typical Wall Street firm, because, you know, our sort of marketing tagline of sorts of through clients' eyes is actually legitimate. And I think the perspective of the individual investor, what they maybe not want, but what we know they probably need, is just very different than the institutional world. And I think approaching investing through the eyes of individual investors is just a sort of different ball game, and there was nobody that preceded me in this role. So when Schwab acquired U.S. Trust in 2000, it was only 10 months after I had joined U.S. Trust. Chuck and our CEO at the time, Dave Podrick, came to New York to meet all the U.S. Trust executives, and they sat down with me and said, "We want to create this role of chief investment strategist. Any interest?" I'm making a longer conversation very short. I said, "Yep."
Hell yeah.
Count me in, and the rest is sort of history. But they gave me a lot of free rein to sort of create this role, but with my full knowledge based on what I know was their mission around the organization of this is through individual client size, and that's a reason why we don't try to do things like market timing or year-end price target. It's about long-term planning and strategic asset allocation and just understanding how markets work and how behavior comes into the mix. So it's just been a great platform for me, and I love it. I hope I'm there for a lot
longer. Another 25 years?
Boy, that would be interesting.
I'd
be my mom's age then.
So you mentioned the culture at Schwab. Let me share a perspective. I don't know if I ever shared this with you. So my firm launched in 2013 with very little money. TD was our custodian.
Okay. And I think I've heard of TD.
Right? Now part of Schwab.
Right. That's right.
And the first couple, and we just, the reason we did that is our prior firm, the clients were custody to TD, and it made it just a single letter, you know, LOA in order to transfer the accounts over. And it took us about a year or two after you hear it for the 100th time where we would go on a road trip. So we were a small shop, but, you know, between our media exposure and everything else, had a national footprint. And we would go to Seattle or San Francisco or Chicago or Austin, Texas. And after you hear it like the 19th time, "Hey, we love you guys. I would love to have you manage our portfolio. But we've been with Schwab and we're not leaving them as our custodian. Let us know as soon as Schwab is one of your platforms." You know, you can only have to hit me over the head with a hammer 14 times before I'm like, "Hey,
maybe we should. Yeah.
And now we have, I think we have, I'm doing this off the top of my head, you know, 4 billion plus on the
Amazing.
Schwab platform from essentially nothing.
Well,
10
you.
Years ago.
On behalf
well,
of
you guys
Schwab.
Have been a great part. You know, I always like to disclose things, but it was dumbfounding in the beginning where it's like, I don't understand. They're custodian. Why?
No, it's a partnership. I'm glad you started
and
to use that.
That's
word.
What we ended right. up learning is, oh, the culture at Schwab and the way they do things, this isn't just, "Hey, leave your money with us. We'll right. send you a statement every quarter," and that was it. It's a very different relationship. And to Chuck's credit, you guys created something that did not exist amongst most custodians Correct. Beforehand. Am I overstating
this?
No,
not at all. And we are, you know, by far the largest in terms of not just custodying assets for the RIA community, but representing that partnership in everything from research and trading and succession planning. It's an important part of our business for sure.
Let's talk a little bit about the markets and the economy today. Starting with, all right, we're at all-time highs in the NASDAQ. We're at all-time highs in the S&P 500. I've heard a bunch of people on TV come out and say, oh, you know, this makes me nervous. What does the data say about what all-time highs in broad indexes mean for the next couple of quarters?
Well, starts to years that have a lot of momentum do tend to carry through, but there's with any data point like that, if you're looking at aggregate data or averages, there are always exceptions to those rules. And as we already talked about, there's been a lot more churn under the surface than what you pick up if you're only looking at index level. But to say that this has been a unique cycle, both on the market side of things and the economy side of things, is the ultimate understatement. And I think that to be an analyst of the market, and one of the nice things for me as strategist at Schwab is that I get to wear the two hats of both market strategist but also economist. We don't have a separate chief economist. And I like that because I get to marry the views. I'm not beholden to somebody else's view on the economy. And on that front, the nature of this economic cycle helps to explain why we've had so many funky things happen in terms of the market cycle. And it's we've been using the rolling recessions terminology because that's actually what has happened in the early part of the pandemic during the stimulus fueled piece of that cycle, that all of that stimulus was essentially funneled into the goods side of the economy because we had no access to services. That Right. was the breeding ground of the inflation problem with which we're still dealing. But we subsequently went into recession-like conditions for many of those goods-oriented categories like manufacturing and housing-related, a lot of consumer-oriented products and goods that were big beneficiaries of the lockdown phase. And we've gone from hyperinflation to disinflation to some deflation based on certain categories of goods. But of course, we've had the later pickup and offsetting strength on the services side. And you've seen that roll through in terms of market behavior too. And it just makes this backdrop kind of an apple compared to history's oranges. And I think we have to be mindful of that when trying to gauge where we are in the market cycle, where we are in the economic cycle. It's a very unique period.
Any other historical parallels that come up? I personally hate the 1970s parallel because you certainly know the employment picture, the inflation picture, the geopolitics, everything was just so much worse than what we're dealing with
today.
It's
a very, very different backdrop relative to the 1970s. I guess the only comparison that we're witnessing right now is the desire on the part of the Fed and maybe Powell in particular to not repeat the mistakes of the 1970s in terms of monetary policy, premature, you know, hanging of the victory banner, easing policy only to see inflation sort of rear its head again. So I think that is maybe one similarity in terms of what the playbook is for the Fed. But I totally agree with you that the nature of what was driving inflation, the backdrop in terms of geopolitics and demographics and labor versus capital is not a mirror of what we're experiencing right now. But I think the Fed took some lessons from the mistakes back in that era.
If you're looking for parallels, and I think you're right, this is totally unique, but the immediate period after World War 100%. II is kind of similar. Yep. You have all these GIs returning and all this pent up, hey, we couldn't do right. all these things, and a spike in inflation yep. that came down, unemployment collapsed because yep. you had all these people coming sure. back to work. It's not perfect.
No, but I think you're right. It was a military war, not a health war, which right. was the case this time. But it had some of those same characteristics in terms of supply-demand imbalances and the drivers of inflation. Obviously, there are plenty of differences,
sure.
Not least being what happened on the other side of it, with which, you know, massive amount of military personnel coming back into the private sector and into the civilian workforce and the rebuilding of the global infrastructure. That is one era that I have used often as a reference point, with that differential being military war versus health war.
So let's talk about some of the other differentials, because I think they're informative. Not only did we bring a lot of technological usage forward, or things that existed. Look, we've had FaceTime for 15 years. It's not like it's new, and screen shares and other things like that, but they just became more widely adopted.
It was forced adoption because we had no choice.
Yeah. But today we have office buildings that are not running full occupancy. Return to office has been, you know, we're 60%, 70% back. You have a lot of hybrid work. You have a lot of people working from home. How does this affect how you perceive the economy? What does this mean for things like, hey, commercial or residential real estate investing?
Yeah, so commercial real estate tends to get thought of too monolithically. Commercial real estate is a very broad category, obviously, right. And it's inclusive of not just the world of offices, but, you know, multifamily residential and warehousing and retail and healthcare facilities, et cetera. So we can't paint commercial real estate with one broad brush. There are segments within CRE that are quite healthy versus, say, office. And even within office, of course, big differentials in terms of urban versus suburban. Certain regions in the country are doing much better. There's the different parts of the country have larger percent that have gone back into that more typical office structure. And then, of course, the exposure to commercial real estate, which is, yes, down into the smaller regional banks, many of the same banks that suffered the most from last year's mini banking crisis. But even there, there's a vast array in terms of maturity schedules and what type of commercial real estate exposure. On our podcast, one of the recent guests that we had on that I interviewed is actually a friend of mine, Al Rabel, who is the founder and CEO of Kayne Anderson, a big, huge private equity, private real estate company. And although they're specifically more involved in student housing and senior housing, he's an expert more broadly. And I asked him at the outset of the interview, I said, let me ask you, an expert, and I'm not an expert, a question about how I've been terming it, how I've been describing it. And feel free to tell me you're dead wrong, Lizanne. I think this is not a Lehman-esque kind of problem. It's more of a slow-moving trade wreck or a simmering problem over time. And fortunately for me, he said, yes, that's, I think, an apt descriptor. That doesn't mean the problems aren't still ahead of us, but it's over a more graduated period of time. And with some of the carnage will come opportunities. And that was maybe a more interesting part of the conversation, is some of the sort of distressed firms looking at this as an eventual opportunity to come in and acquire some of these properties at, you know, significant discounts. So with carnage comes opportunity.
I'm glad you brought up private equity, because during the era of zero interest rates, when you couldn't really find any sort of yield in the public markets, private equity, private debt,
venture,
right? Yep. Pretty good numbers, 7, 8, 9% yield versus 2, 3%. Now that the risk-free rate is in the threes or fours, and muni bonds are giving you the tax equivalent of, depending on the state, 6, 7, 8% yield. How do you think about private equity?
Yeah, it's not my area. So I'm gonna answer the question by tying it back to something that is I spend more time thinking about. To the point you made in the early part of asking that question, was what was a shift in the zero interest rate environment by many investors that were looking for anything resembling a decent yield, and it forced them just out the risk spectrum.
Right.
Whether it was to riskier segments of the fixed income market or into the publicly traded equity markets, or to your point, into the private markets, be it private equity or venture. And for many of investors, they weren't really comfortable with that kind of risk. And it's not just the risk, but for many investors, it's the transparency and liquidity that they had to give up. Now we have an environment wherein essentially hold to maturity, risk-free treasuries and things like, you know, money market funds. A lot of money has gone back in that direction. On that note, and this is somewhat tangential, but I think it's important, too many people view the $6 trillion that's sitting in money markets as some, maybe not imminent, but some huge source of funding for the equity market.
Cash on the sidelines.
On the sidelines.
Right.
I think I think a lot of that money is actually probably fairly sticky. It's money that represents the cash needs or the liquidity side of asset allocation and isn't sitting there just waiting to go into riskier assets, be it public equity markets or private. I think a lot of that is probably fairly sticky.
And it migrated to money market funds because of the 5.3% yields. After a drought of decades of not getting any sort of
That's
yield,
right.
Hey, I could earn a real rate of return, relatively risk-free. Great. I'm going to reduce my risk profile
right.
and capture some of this.
That's a great thing.
I've never really understood that cash on the sideline. The other thing that's related, and you might see it from your perch at Schwab, whenever people talk about fund flows, look at all this money flowing into equity funds are flowing out, it seems like it's a year behind what the market's doing. The market crashes and then there are fund flows out. Look at 21 or 23. Even as the market is rallying, the funds are flowing in the opposite direction.
Performance chasing up and down. That's, you know, as old as the day is long.
It's just that simple. It's just performance chasing.
And, you know, the other thing about the $6 trillion that's in money market funds is, yes, that's an all-time record in level terms, but relative to total stock market capitalization, it's nowhere near a record. So you have to be careful. First of all, number one, I think it's a mistake to our point that we just made, that this is not sort of short-term cash on the sidelines, that it's just itching to jump over onto the equity side of things. But even if you make that assumption, the firepower has to be put in the context of share of market capitalization. And there, it's nowhere near a record high.
That's really interesting. So we've talked a little bit about the Fed. We haven't really delved into too much about inflation. You hinted at it before. And CPI peaked in June 2022. How do you look at where we are today in the first quarter of 24, and what does that mean for people's portfolios?
So we think the disinflation trend is still largely intact, but it doesn't mean it is linear and will quickly get down to the Fed's 2% target. Obviously, there's a lot of components within inflation metrics, not to mention lots of ways of measuring inflation. And we can talk about the Fed's preferred measure of PCE, and then there's core PCE or
super core,
you know, ex shelter. And there's the differentials in terms of how things like the shelter components are measured and calculated and what share they represent of metrics like CPI versus PCE. I'd say one of the more important things that has happened this year is, number one, Powell and other members of the Fed have emphasized more the rates of change, the 3-month rate of change, the 6-month rate of change. And then specifically in the 60-minute interview that Powell did following the January FOMC meeting, he started talking more about the 12-month rate of change. I think that was a way to almost quantify the notion that they want to make sure that if and when inflation comes down to or near the target, that there's sustainability to that mm-hmm. it's not just a sort of a quick shot down and they fear the risk of it moving back up again. In terms of what's happened very recently is that not only did we have the hotter than expected January CPI report, for both CPI and PCE, the 3-month rate of change has turned back up. The 6-month rate of change has turned back up. The 12-month hasn't yet, but based on how these things work,
right.
If 3-month is moving up, 6-month is moving up, 12-month is probably going to start moving up. And that's part and parcel of why the shift has occurred from a March start to then it was a May start. Maybe it's not until June, and you've really condensed the expectation around the number of rate hikes, not to mention that there are a few.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, It's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Strategists out there more recently that are saying maybe they don't cut at all this year. I think the market definitely was way over its skis earlier in the year when it expected not just a March start, but 6 rate cuts. There was just nothing in the data that the Fed is supposed to be monitoring on either side of their dual mandate that suggested such an aggressive pivot. And I would also say to a lot of investors, I was saying at the time, be careful what you wish for. If you think after the most aggressive tightening cycle in 40 years that in short order they're going to pivot to an aggressive rate cutting cycle, the background conditions supporting that are probably not what you would want to see either as an economic participant or as a market participant. So
you wear an economics hat. I have this discussion all the time with people. Someone said, imagine how great the economy would be if oil was $30 a barrel. And I said, hey, if you want $30 a barrel oil, you need a really deep recession.
Yeah, global.
It doesn't happen out of context. Right. The idea of careful what you wish for,
right.
You want 6 rate cuts. That means the economy is
recession.
Is having a hard time. Yeah. So since we have you wearing the economist hat, where's my recession? I was promised recession.
Well, we had the rolling recessions.
But I was promised a full recession in 22 and then 23. And not only did we not have a recession, unemployment fell to the mid-3s. Yep. GDP is robust. When you look around the world, this isn't, all right, everybody is with the cleanest shirt in the hamper. It's not that. We have a robust growth economy, and the rest of the world doesn't seem to be.
So here's what happened. It's in the context of this whole notion of the roll through. When we had the individual sectoral recessions in manufacturing and housing related, and a lot of consumer oriented products, and it did end up with negative GDP for the first 6 months of 2022.
Right.
The reason why
negative on a real basis,
right, on a real
nominal
basis,
it wasn't.
It wasn't, but you had and not that back to back. Negative GDP quarters is the definition of a recession. It's
right.
Not. It never has been the definition of a recession.
Thank you for saying that.
I'm shocked. And when people say, well, the traditional or the typical, it's not. The NBER has been the official arbiters of recession since the mid-1970s, and 2 quarters in a row of negative GDP has never been the definition. The key line, perhaps, within that much more comprehensive definition that the NBER uses that helps to explain why 6 months of negative GDP ultimately wasn't declared a recession. Again, not because it was 2 quarters in a row, but the key part of the NBER's definition is spread across the economy. The weakness that led to the first half of 2022 having no real growth in the economy was concentrated. It was concentrated on the good side of the economy, manufacturing. We had the offsetting strength in services. Services is a larger employer by far, helping to explain the resilience in the labor market. The services components of inflation are stickier by nature, including the shelter components, helping to explain the roll through in inflation. And again, it's just another example of the unique nature of this cycle. So I think when I look forward, I think, okay, so if and when services has their day in the clouds and we start to see more than just some cracks that we've started to see, like an ISM services employment component going back into contraction territory, what you may get is you have a roll through of recoveries in areas or at least stabilization that have already taken their hits. A lot of people view no landing as best case scenario. There's going to be a landing. You know, at some point the plane lands. But I do think a near-term no-landing scenario might also mean a no-cutting scenario.
Mm-hmm.
And then the question, which I don't know that I have an answer to, is what exactly has been propelling the stock market? Is it the prospect of easier monetary policy, or is it that growth has more than hung in there? And that translates to better top-line growth, better bottom-line growth, maybe a little bit of both, but it's hard to sort of isolate one or the other as the key driver.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because anytime I'm at a dinner party, I'm at a barbecue, I'm somewhere, and the dominant narrative is thrown at me. So what happens to the markets if the Fed doesn't cut sooner or later? And my answer is always, why do you think that whatever that news headline is what's driving the markets? First of all, there's 100 factors or a million factors, right?
Yeah.
And second, just because it's on TV or online or in the newspapers doesn't mean...
I love that. And I know it's the job of journalists. If I'm doing an interview on the phone with a print reporter, or if I'm going on a TV program, and especially if questions are concentrated around what the market is doing, you know, that particular day.
Right.
And the question is always some form of, you know, what drove the market today, or what turned the market at, you know, midday, as if the market is sort of this inanimate thing that just sits around waiting for one particular news headline. And on any given day, any given week, if you just change the sign on what the market was doing, I could come up with plenty of things to point to say, this is why the market boomed today, or this is why the market went down. It is kind of silly.
But no one likes the answer, how do I know?
Right.
People are not satisfied with that.
I try more often than not to answer questions, especially that are about sort of what's the market going to do with, I have no idea. Sometimes I pause for effect, like that. Well, that's the truth. I assume you're going to have follow up questions for me, and that's not what the listeners or the viewers want to hear. I don't know, but anyone answering that question, that's the honest answer. Is, I don't know.
100%. And people don't realize that makes matters worse. The journalist writes up the story. Someone else writes the headline, and they're looking for the clickiest, most salacious 100%. Thing 100%. To pull out. How many times have you read a story where you read the headline and the story has nothing to do with it? Right. It's really true. I don't know is probably the most underused phrase on Wall Street. And it really should be, because, you know, first of all, it's great when you do it on live TV. You get a question. So where's the market going to be in a year?
I don't know.
How am I supposed to know? Yeah. Nobody knows.
And again, like 1987's example, even if you nailed 1987 and said flat, the market's not going to do anything.
No one's going to believe
you. Oh, yes,
you.
It is. The market is going to do a lot. It just, right. It's not going to end the year with much to show for it.
That's really funny. So given everything we've said about the markets, the duck paddling underneath, what's going on below the surface, how should investors think about forward expectations? What should they think about? Hey, you know, we've been seeing the 2010s market. What do we average? 13, 14% a year? Even with some bad quarters in that, the rest of 2020 was amazing. 21 was huge. 23 was huge. Here we are starting out 24 strong. At what point should investors begin to moderate return expectations?
Well, the discipline of rebalancing keeps you in gear in perpetuity without having to figure out, okay, is this the moment I want to lessen risk in my portfolio or take more risk in my portfolio? But I think the two key risks right now have more to do with called the internals of the market than anything out there that we're observing as risk. Obviously, you know, geopolitics and the election and black swan risks are always the potential, but I think sentiment and valuation. Now, the one important caveat around saying sentiment and valuation are a risk, in this case, meaning sentiment's gotten pretty frothy, both attitudinal measures and behavioral measures, and valuation is fairly stretched, is the important caveat is neither, even at extremes, represents anything resembling a market timing tool. As we all learned in the 1990s, valuation can get stretched and sentiment can get stretched, and that can last for years. What it does is set up maybe a risk factor to the extent there's a negative catalyst when you sort of have everyone on one side of the boat and you're priced for perfection. But again, that environment can last. But I would certainly put both of those in the risk column in terms of what could the potential negative catalyst be that could cause a contrarian move relative to optimistic sentiment. Well, we've already talked about a lot of them. It could be something outsized in terms of inflation or the Fed policy, you know, reaction function. Geopolitics is ever present. Given that 2023 was a very low volatility year, you've got the likelihood of mean reversion, and you throw the election into the mix as a potential volatility driver. I don't think that's a stretch. Otherwise, I think you stay up in quality within the equity portion of the portfolio. I think factor-based investing makes a lot more sense than monolithic groups of stocks, or even maybe at the sector level, investing based on characteristics and looking for quality companies with strong balance sheets and ample interest coverage and strong free cash flow and positive earnings trends and revisions, and apply that analysis across the spectrum of sectors and even cap ranges.
Really informative and insightful. Let's jump to our speed round, our favorite questions that we ask all of our guests. starting with, tell us what's entertaining you. What are you watching or listening or streaming these days?
So I don't read a lot of books. Every once in a while, I'll listen to them, but I'm a big podcast listener, aside from our own and yours. I've always been a fan of Masters in Business.
I always tell people, you don't have to mention
this. No. I've been a regular listener of Masters in Business in podcast form and listening to you on the radio. So
even in the beginning when it was terrible.
I'm a longtime fan. No, well, because I was a guest sort of in the beginning.
Right.
So,
you weren't sort of. You were one of the early guests. When I couldn't get anyone on, I worked my way through my personal phone book. And then...
when you couldn't get anybody on, you got me on?
Yeah. No. Seriously. The general response to requests was no. When I asked somebody I knew personally, I don't mean you weren't anybody. When I asked someone I knew, all right, I'll do you a favor. Because really, nobody's paying attention to this. That was then. Now it's 10 million a year.
But I am a fan. Grant Williams has a few podcasts, and mm-hmm. he always has really fascinating guests on.
Very eclectic mix of people.
Very eclectic mix. But I like that it's often macro-focused. And there's a number of other podcasts sporadically that I'll listen to outside of the world of finance. I'm a big Smartless fan.
Oh,
just,
sure.
I mean, they're just so funny and so lovely and brilliant. And
I
so
think they just... sold
just
that
sold.
For an ungodly amount
yes,
of money,
good
too.
For them. Good
yeah.
for them. Good for
yeah,
them.
That's
and then streaming, I guess the one that I'm in the midst of now is Feud, Capote versus the Swans.
Really?
Yes. So it's not a documentary, but it's, you know, based on true stories, but with great actors playing parts, and it's multi-episode, and so that's a good one that I'm into right now.
So I kind of know the answer to this question, but I want to ask it anyway for anyone listening this deep into the podcast. Tell us about your early mentors. Who shaped your career?
So Marty Zweig, clearly.
Obviously, right.
Louis Rukeyser, in terms of my entree into the world of television and learning what matters and what doesn't matter. And I got it. Chuck Schwab.
I know you said you're too busy reading research reports to read a lot of books. In addition to Winning on Wall Street by Marty Zweig, any other books you would recommend to someone interested?
Yes. So one of the best books I ever got about investing was Given to Be My Marty when I started in the business in 1986. And it's a little book. It's paperback. A lot of people have probably heard of it, but Reminiscences of a Stock Operator. It's just so fabulous. And I also like, and it's similar in its sort of size and structure with paperback, Where Are the Customer's Yachts?
Uh-huh.
So those are my two. And then, you know, Winning on Wall Street. I got to plug Marty's book, and that still resonates even today. Right now, at times, I'm listening to a book, and I'll listen to, you know, 15 minutes at a time and then not listen to it for months and months. It is by Nathaniel Philbrick, and it's just the history of Nantucket,
which is
my place I spend parts of the summer, and about the era from the 1600s into the 1700s when it was the whaling capital of the world. And so that's a
I'm going to share a book with you only because you are now in Naples. I just finished reading Bubble in the Sun, The History of Florida Real Estate Booms and Busts.
Ah.
And the theory is the Florida real estate boom in the 20s is the biggest migration in U.S. history. And its collapse was one of the factors that led to the Great Depression.
Ah.
It's an deeply researched, absolutely fascinating.
That. All right, good.
I think you would really appreciate that.
I'm going to add it to my list.
Our final two questions. What sort of advice would you give to a recent college grad interested in going into finance or investment?
I would say, and this is advice I would give to a college grad going really into just about any industry, but I think maybe finance a little bit more. Too many college grads think coming into finance, it's about, well, what did I learn in college? What courses did I take? To be fairly honest, it doesn't matter. You're not bringing something into the mix that the company doesn't already know. So the more broad advice I always give to people who are starting out and they're going through the interview process is there always seems to be this strong desire to come across as interesting. Be interested. Focus more on being interested than being interesting.
Huh. Good advice. And our final question, what do you know about the world of investing today you wish you knew 36 years ago when you were first getting started?
To start early and young.
Start early and young.
Yep.
The magic of compounding.
The magic of compounding. And even if it means sacrificing a little of the pleasures when you're much younger and you're trying to divide a very small amount of money into, you know, fun versus savings versus work, is starting early is just so powerful, even if it's just putting it in some version of savings.
Lizanne, this has been just absolutely delightful.
Thank you
so much for being so generous with your time and allowing me to really improve on our first conversation, which in preparation for this, I listened to and was just utterly mortified.
Oh, I disagree with you.
Because of me.
I didn't listen to the whole thing. At your suggestion, I listened to the
first
5 or 10 minutes, and I still remember it like it was yesterday.
I remember sitting in that darkened room around that round table, you, me, and Larry, literally my first television appearance. I want to say that was like 03, something crazy like that.
Yeah, it might have been.
So anyway, we have been speaking with the delightful Lizanne Noe Saunders, Chief Investment Strategist at Schwab, helping to oversee over $8 trillion on their platform. If you enjoy this conversation, well, be sure and check out any of our previous 500 discussions we've had over the past 10 years. You can find those at iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, wherever you find your favorite podcasts. Be sure to check out my new podcast, At the Money, short 10-minute questions and answers with experts about your money. I'm really enjoying doing this podcast to just get to the meat of an issue. 10 minutes, you can find those in your Masters in Business feed. I would be remiss if I did not thank the crack team that helps us put these conversations together each week. Robert Bragg is my audio engineer. Atika Valbron is my project manager. Anna Luke is my producer. Sean Russo is my researcher. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.